I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. President Trump is visiting five Asian countries as he leaves on the longest foreign trip of his presidency. He starts in Hawaii today, then makes stops in Japan, followed by South Korea, China, Vietnam, and ending in the Philippines before heading back home. The threats from North Korea, the conflict over the South China Sea, China's growing dominance in the region and the world, trade, and Trump's domestic struggles will be key challenges facing the administration as the president meets his Asian counterparts. We have two guests who have joined us on Radio Times to talk about what to expect and some of those challenges. And joining us from Beijing, China, is Simon Denyer, and he is the Washington Post's Asia Bureau Chief. Simon, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here. Thanks very much.
You're very welcome. And with us here in our Philadelphia studios is Jacques Delisle. He's a professor of law and political science at the University of Pennsylvania, deputy director of the University's Center for the Study of Contemporary China, also directs the Foreign Policy Research Institute's Asia program. Jacques Delisle, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be back. Thanks.
Let me start with you, Jacques, and Simon, I'd like to get you in on the conversation as well. What would be a successful trip for the president and for the United States?
Well, I think there's fairly low expectations about what will come out of this trip. We know that there will be no joint communique coming out of the joint statement coming out of the China part of it, which is the highest profile undertaking. So not a trip where we're expecting a lot of deliverables. I think to some extent this is ally reassurance time. South Korea, Japan have been somewhat skittish about the degree of commitment of the Trump administration. There's obviously a principal goal. If you look at what the articulated goals of the program of the trip are, the White House has stressed the creation or support of a free and open Indo-Pacific. So it's this attempt to fold the whole region, including India, into this broader framework. There is a pursuit of free and reciprocal trade. This is essentially a dig at the trade imbalances that have been a focus for Trump and his economic team. And, of course, hardly last, or last but certainly not least, is an attempt to rally everybody in the region to pressure North Korea on the nuclear weapons program. So I think a lot of it is allied reassurance and trying to get progress on these things. But this doesn't have the buildup of a summit that's going to, or a series of visits that's going to have a lot of deliverables.
Simon, you're in Beijing. What is the, I guess, expectation, or even what is the mood in China as they anticipate the president's arrival?
It's a very good question. I mean, I think that what we've seen under President Trump is a relationship with the Chinese, which is very much president to president, and the Chinese will be looking for a good relationship, a good meeting between the two presidents to see off some of the things which make them uneasy. So President Trump will be coming, asking, as Jack said, for stronger action on North Korea. He'll also, we presume, be asking, they say they will be asking for greater economic access to Chinese markets, more rebalancing of the trade relationship, so an economic aspect too. The Chinese are going to flatter Trump. They're already calling this a state visit plus. So they're going to throw everything at him to try and flatter his ego and perhaps to try and sidetrack him, from those demands.
Well, they meaning President Trump and the Chinese leader Xi Jinping had met in Mar-a-Lago a couple of months ago. But in that time, Simon, Chinese leader Xi has really consolidated his power in China. Does that change, you think, the dynamic between these two leaders?
You know, President Xi and China had been very keen to keep the U.S. relationship on an even keel in the lead-up to the Party Congress. That's one of the reasons they were, putting stronger pressure on the North Koreans than perhaps they might have wanted to, because they didn't want to upset the U.S. relationship coming into the Party Congress. Now that President Xi has got through the Party Congress, now that he's consolidated power, as you said, the question is, are they going to be a little bit more difficult to deal with as far as the U.S. is concerned? Is a confident China going to be more assertive in saying, no, we're not prepared to go any further on North Korea, actually? We've gone as far as we want to go. So it's very hard to say because Chinese politics is a complete black box. There are experts all over the world who spend a great deal of time trying to peer into that black box and come to very different conclusions. So I'm not going to make any any confident predictions, but I do think that a confident China does mean a more assertive China in the longer term.
Well, you have peered into that black box, Dr. Leal, to use Simon Denyer's words here. But Xi did talk about a new era has begun. What does that mean for the United States and for the president?
Well, it's clearly a more assertive China. Again, as Simon quietly says, we don't know much about what goes on inside the black box, but we do see some of its outputs. And there's always, of course, a question of how much to take literally or seriously, but not literally, things that are said at major occasions like the 19th Party Congress. But what was striking about Xi's marathon 3-hour-plus speech was a sense that China is going to be much more assertive, at least in the long run. I mean, there's a little bit of hedging about when China sees itself reaching that level of truly great power, and there's a long-time horizon for some of those things. But clearly, they're feeling their oats. They're feeling that presence, and we've seen a couple of things that really are pushbacks against the United States. So, for instance, the praising of the building up of the landforms in the South China Sea, those islands, was touted as one of the major accomplishments of his first 5 years. And we are seeing a variety of intimations that China now sees itself as perhaps providing a model for other developing countries about the path they might follow. If you line that up with the way Xi has approached the economy, that suggests a lack of willingness to listen to some of the U.S. calls on market liberalization and matters of that ilk. That said, I would agree with what Simon said, which is that China is under some pressure to make some concessions, at least on the trade front. And the Chinese ambassador to the U.S., Tse Tian-Kai, hinted that the two things you might see significant statements on at this meeting would be North Korea and trade.
Just picking up on something, Simon, I'll toss this to you. President Trump did congratulate Xi for his extraordinary elevation. I believe those are the words that he used, calling he has called him a very good person. And it does raise the question about what is the United States, even predating President Trump, what is our relationship with China?
It's a very complicated and very wide-ranging relationship. But, you know, one thing that the relationship is supposed to stand for from the U.S. side is the ideas of democracy and free speech and human rights. Those are supposed to be principles which unite the United States with its allies in Asia. So there is a question in Asia whether those – and sorry, just to add, the value of free trade as well. I mean, that's also, you know, an important aspect of what the U.S. stands for. So, you know, Jack was talking about reassuring the allies. I do think that there is a question in the allies. What does the United States stand for in the Asia-Pacific region? Does it still stand for those values? If you praise the president of China as a very nice guy, you know, if you praise him for his extraordinary elevation in a one-party system, in what is one of the most repressive eras that China's faced in a very long time, you do wonder what the United States stands for in terms of the U.S.-China relationship and in terms of what it stands for in the Asia-Pacific region as a whole. So I think, you know, that's a question which needs to be asked. I don't expect we'll get much in the way of clarity on it from President Trump over the next couple of weeks.
And I do want to talk about North Korea, but I know, Jacques, you want to weigh in on that.
Yeah, I'd say that's absolutely right, and it's actually a bit deeper than that in terms of where the U.S. has gone on these issues. Secretary of State Tillerson has openly said that maybe democracy promotion shouldn't be a core pursuit of the State Department. There's been some walking back on that, but that statement is out there. That area is one of the many areas in which posts have not been filled in the State Department, and Trump is not only saying flattering things about Xi Jinping, he's also warmed up to Duterte, who has not exactly got the best human rights record as the leader of the Philippines.
Well, we're talking about extrajudicial killings.
Indeed.
Well, in fact, let me just quote. We will get to North Korea. I just want to quote. This was a conversation between President Trump and Duterte I have the transcript here. President Trump says to Duterte, I just want to congratulate you because I'm hearing of the unbelievable job on the drug problem. Many countries have the problem. We have the problem, but what a great job you're doing. I just wanted to call and tell you that. And Duterte says, thank you, Mr. President. This is a scourge of my nation now. I have to do something to preserve the Filipino nation. You want to just weigh in on that, Jack?
Well, I mean, that's obviously extraordinary language. And Duterte had been very, very critical of the United States under Obama. The Chinese have long chafed at U.S. pressure on human rights issues, and those things have flipped about 180 degrees.
Right. How about for you, Simon? Anything you want to add to that?
Yes, I mean, I think anybody that looks at what's happening in the Philippines and looks at thousands of unaccounted, unexplained deaths, extrajudicial killings, looks at those remarks with a certain degree of horror, I think. You know, it's not an easy position for the United States to be in. Duterte has played this, you know, very smartly, actually. He's managed to get the U.S., Japan, and China all competing for his favor. But in a sense, he's getting money from all three of them now, and he's playing one off, you know, he's playing the U.S. And Japan on one side off against China on the other side. But I do think that countries in the region, leaders in the region, respect consistency and strength. And, you know, by sort of abandoning what the U.S. stands for, it doesn't actually strengthen the U.S. position. If the U.S. was able to say, we stand for these values, we will always stand for these values, then countries factor that into the relationship. And in a sense, you know, that's easier for them to deal with. But when questions are raised about what the United States stands for, then I think it becomes easier for people like Duterte to play different countries off against each other.
I do want to pick up on that, but I do want to get to the threat of North Korea and its relationship with China. To you, Jacques, what do you think the President of the United States, can do during this trip to in any way move China towards doing something else to try to contain North Korea?
Well, I think
are there any options there?
I don't think there are a lot of great options. I mean, clearly one of the purposes of this trip is to rally pressure, which has clearly been the Trump agenda since coming to office. It's obviously a long-term problem. Trump does seem to engage in quite personal diplomacy. So the warm relationship with Abe, which was forged partly at Mar-a-Lago, the Prime Minister of Japan, which was forged partly at Mar-a-Lago after some really tough words about Japan, primarily on economic issues during the campaign. Similar, although milder, version of the story with China, where, again, very harsh rhetoric about China, mostly economic during the campaign. And then there was the beautiful chocolate cake incident at Mar-a-Lago, where Trump and Xi seem to have developed some rapport, and there'll be a Chinese equivalent of the glowing Saudi Arabian orb or something to be good optics in Beijing. So I think there is this personal element which he's going to try to bring into play to rally the pressure. But there's a real limit to what you can do. I think what we've got is a situation where China is increasingly frustrated with North Korea. I mean, it's China's closest formal ally. But it's become more and more of an embarrassment, partly because the regime is ever more roguish, and because I think China has to recognize that what North Korea has been up to under the current Kim, under Kim Jong-un, is a step beyond where we've been before. The building up the nuclear weapons program, the ballistic missiles, the threats to neighbors are becoming much more tangible, as well as the threats to the United States. China can't really say you shouldn't pay attention to those. And most Chinese foreign policy types will tell you that they don't have fine-grained control over North Korea. They might have the ability to inflict a great deal of pain at high risk, but they can't sort of manipulate day-to-day. They've pushed reforms, and they haven't taken it, and now I think it's a tough situation.
That's Jacques Delisle. Also joining us, Simon Denyer. We're talking about President Trump's trip to Asia. It begins today. And Simon, I'm sure you want to weigh in on the relationship between China and North Korea. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Artie Moscowane. I'm talking with Simon Denyer, who is in Beijing, China. He is the China Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Jacques Delisle, and he is a professor of law and political science at the University of Pennsylvania, heads up the Foreign Policy Research Institute's Asia program, and also the University Center for the Study of Contemporary China. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Any questions or comments about President Trump's trip to Asia? It's about 12 days, five countries. It's a pretty long trip, even for a new president. I want to give you a chance, Simon, just to talk a little bit about China's relationship with North Korea and what, if anything, China either wants to do or can do to try to contain its nuclear aspirations.
Right. Well, I mean, Jack's absolutely right. The Chinese are extremely frustrated with the North Koreans, who've been poking their nose at the Chinese at almost every opportunity, letting off missiles and nuclear tests at times, particularly at times that are embarrassing for China, when it's been hosting summits and so on. But, you know, the Chinese do not want to push the North Koreans into a corner. They do not want to have a hostile nuclear-armed state on their border, which is collapsing and dangerous as it collapses. They do not want to have regime change. They do not want to see one of their communist brethren fall, if you like. You know, a blood brother, as many of the sort of traditionalists in the Chinese Communist Party would see the North Koreans. And they do not want to have war erupting right on their border. So they do not want this situation to go into that kind of crisis. So they are not prepared. They are not prepared to do anything as drastic as, for example, cutting off the crude oil pipeline which supplies the North Korean regime and military. They're not going to go that far. And so the question really is, you know, are they prepared to go much further than they're currently doing? And is this kind of action really going to change North Korea's strategic thinking? Because the North Koreans, the pain that's being inflicted at the moment is really nothing to North Korea compared to its strategic goal of having this nuclear weapon. So we're in a situation where the Chinese don't feel they can take a step which would change that North Korean strategic calculation. They don't want to force this into a crisis. So they, in a sense, their strategy, if they have a strategy, and I don't think anybody has a good strategy to deal with North Korea, but if the Chinese have a hope, it's that the North Koreans will get to a point where they have developed a nuclear weapon which can threaten the United States, and then the North Koreans will be prepared to sit down and talk with the United States about not escalating the tension further. In other words, about containment at that point. That's pretty much all that's on the table as far as the Chinese are concerned. I think they talk about other plans, freezing missile development in return for the U.S., you know, halting its military exercises with the South Koreans, which really is a non-starter. So, you know, the Chinese do not want to push the North Koreans into a corner, and I really don't think they will.
Well, Jack, let me get you to weigh in on that. And what I hear Simon describing is living with a nuclear North Korea and even expanding beyond that to South Korea, and obviously Japan is implicated as well.
Yeah. So the official position of the United States remains that we will not accept a nuclear-armed North Korea. That's the precondition. Most anyone's going to tell you that's not going to happen. Right. That is, you cannot sanction the North Korean regime into giving up its nuclear weapons. It is for Kim a personal survival issue. It is for the North Korean regime a regime survival issue. And for North Korea, it's probably ultimately a state survival issue. There's very little possibility of great movement on that. Now, there's a difference between accepting it as a fact about the world and recognizing North Korea as a nuclear power. There are various things that fall from that. But if that's a precondition, actually getting rid of the weapons, not going to happen, absent running some very, very big risks that I don't think people are willing to run. So that's one problem. The second problem is, as Simon's saying, China has its agenda, which doesn't line up very nicely with the U.S. agenda. Yeah. I mean, everybody would like a nice, stable Korean peninsula, would ideally like North Korea not to have nuclear weapons. China has no interest in that either. But once you get away from the best-case scenario, and we have shared worst-case scenarios, right, a real conflagration. But in between, the U.S. and China have different bad-case scenarios. China worries about a disorderly collapse in North Korea, whether due to American intervention or some measure of sanctions that actually does create unrest. And then they have refugee problems, and they have a united Korean peninsula under Seoul's government, which is generally a pro-U.S. government, of course. And the U.S. worries about very different things, having the U.S. and its allies live under the shadow of North Korean threats, and, of course, proliferation, the idea that this technology will be spread to third countries and perhaps to non-state actors.
Just one quick follow-up. Simon, I'll put this to you since you're in China. When President Trump name calls or calls out, and I'm thinking about the leader of North Korea, when he calls him the names that he did, do people just roll their eyes? Do they get worried? Do they laugh? What is the impact in the region for that kind of language coming from the President of the United States?
Well, I mean, I think people do raise their eyes. One of the things that has changed in a sense, and I haven't, you know, this is from people who've been there recently, but people who've been colleagues and friends of mine who've been in South Korea say that this is actually changing a little bit the mood in South Korea, that the South Koreans have been up till now fairly relaxed about the situation. You know, they've lived with North Korea for a very long time, and you know, they go about their normal lives. You have to go about your normal life, not worrying about the threat of war. But the problem with having a sort of a volatile U.S. president as well as a potentially volatile North Korean president does inject a new sense of risk. So in a sense, the South Koreans are at least as worried about what President Trump might do as they are about what President Kim north of the border might do. And so having, you know, there are certain times when being unpredictable, being a bit outspoken can be an advantage. It can sort of put your enemies, if you like, or you know, not your enemies, your rivals, on the back foot. But in this case, I think a little bit of calm might help everybody. And I think that these kind of volatile, sort of outspoken comments also play into the narrative that the U.S., you know, might do something rather rash, and that's not helpful.
And the president is going to South Korea, to Seoul. Jacques, South Korea has a new president itself. He's a civil rights lawyer, as I understand it. How is he different from his predecessor, and how does that either open up new options for the U.S. or change our relationship with that country?
So it is a switch in parties. It's going from the right-leaning party to the left-leaning party. President Park, whom he replaced, was the heir to one of the conservative line of leaders, back to the pre-democratization days even in South Korea. And now you've got somebody who's more in the tradition of Kim Dae-jung and other sort of left-leaning Korean presidents. So that's a very new arrangement. And he inherited the question of the missile defense. So there's this thing called THAAD, the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, which the U.S. was putting in place in South Korea to help defend against the North Korean ballistic missile threat. China didn't like it because the radar could be used in ways that were adverse to China's interests, and there was concern that it would be the first link in a U.S.-Japan-South Korea perimeter defense. And there was a question about whether Moon would continue with the deployments, and for a while it looked like he might not. Now he's going to go ahead with that, but still we've seen a rewarming of China-South Korea relations after the initial pushback against the missile defense deployment, and that complicates Trump's agenda, because if the goal is, and it clearly is, to get the South Koreans, the Japanese, on the same page with the U.S. and therefore bring more pressure to bear on China to deal with North Korea, that becomes more problematic as South Korea China relations are thawing a bit, and we have a new president in South Korea who's a little more open to the negotiation path with the North. But I agree with what Simon said, that we have this really unprecedented situation where the volatility is not just from Pyongyang, it's also from Washington. And it's partly from the variety of things that Trump says, and it's then even more the variety of things the administration says when you have Mattis, Secretary of Defense, Tillerson, the Secretary of State, and others going out to try and walk back some of the more inflammatory remarks. I mean, Tillerson says he has back channels, and Trump says no, negotiation is futile. That is a serious set of mixed signals, and unpredictability, as Simon says, can be bad for your enemies or your rivals. It can be helpful in trying to deal with them. Not a great way to deal with your allies, especially when your allies are a little shaky. Mm-hmm. One note of optimism here,
yes,
though,
go ahead.
Is that one of the things that I think China realizes is that North Korea is a diplomatic albatross for them now. It's an embarrassment. And the bad case scenario for China is that this pushes, in combination with doubts about U.S. support for our allies in the region, it may push South Korea and Japan to develop nuclear weapons. And that's not something China wants to see happen. It's not generally good for regional stability. But when you're citing that as a symbol of optimism, yeah, we're in a bad place.
That's Jacques Delisle from the University of Pennsylvania joining us here, excuse me, in our Philadelphia studio. And joining us from Beijing, China, is Simon Denyer. And he's the China bureau chief for the Washington Post. And again, talking about President Trump's trip to Southeast Asia or South Asia. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Any questions or comments? Also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. I should add that there was some question about whether President Trump would attend the East Asia Summit. And as of this morning, he will. So that is a slight change in his itinerary. Let me talk a little bit about the South China Sea. And this is complicated. And only because, Jacques, I'm looking at you. help us understand what this conflict is about.
How far back do you want to go?
Well, we have, let's say, 3 minutes.
Okay. So the basic idea here is that China has very expansive claims in the South China Sea. For those who've looked at the maps, you'll see there's this so-called nine-dash line that runs in this big cow-tongue U-shaped curve far away from China down to very near the coasts of Vietnam, Malaysia, the Philippines, other countries in the area. And there are lots of tiny little landforms in that space. China occupies some of them. It does not occupy anywhere near a majority of them, but it claims all of them. Other states claim some subset of them. And the biggest controversy in recent years has been that China has been building up landforms.
Literally
dredging sand and taking these tiny little atolls, these little rocks, and turning them into bases, in effect. And so we've seen is seven landforms where China has done some reclamation, three particularly big ones, and there they are now stationing ships. They have military capability. They have airfields. And so this is at least a twofold problem. One is that these are disputed territorial areas. Other states claim these too. And for a long time, we've had, you know, skirmishes here and there, and it has gotten bad at moments in the past, but for a while it had been just sort of tension-filled. Now we see sort of concrete actions being taken that raise concerns about China's acquisition of the ability to impede traffic through what is one of the world's most important shipping lanes.
Oh, is that the fear? That's
the fear. That basically, this puts China in control. It gives them a forward basing area where they really could choke off access and have taken landforms that are claimed by the Philippines and Vietnam and others. So that's one of the things that's going to come up in Vietnam. Complicated whether it comes up in the Philippines or something I'll get to in one moment. But basically, China has this geographically expansive set of claims, and based on the control of those very small landforms, exerts rights over vast ocean territories in the area. There's a complicated regime under the law of the sea, but what China does is it claims all these tiny landforms, ratchets them up to as high a status as possible, claims expansive maritime areas from that, and then claims very expansive rights, including rights to regulate what the U.S. Navy and other navies do in those spaces that are inconsistent with the U.S. and really majority view of international law, which is more open seas here. So we've got a real clash on open seas versus closed seas in a highly strategic area. It's also seen as a more general marker of Chinese assertiveness. Now, what happened last summer, a year ago, was an arbitration decision under the law of the sea regime with an arbitration panel in The Hague, which decided very much in favor of the Philippines and against China. It essentially rejected the vast majority of these Chinese claims, and so we thought we're going to see a big confrontation. The Philippines then changed government, and Duterte, who wants a much better relationship with China and who actually, to be fair, realized it was going to be darn hard to implement this decision, took a step back. That left the U.S. kind of hanging. So we still do pushback. We still do freedom of navigation operations to assert the rights of the 7th Fleet, the U.S. Navy, to operate in the areas, but it is a growing flashpoint. It's on the agenda, and it's especially going to be on the agenda with Vietnam, which is the most important, or at least the most powerful claimant in the region. Philippines, too, but as I said, they've backed off their claims on.
And Simon, are we heading for an even more dangerous conflict over the South China Sea, over control, obviously?
Well, I mean, in a sense, the fact that the Philippines has backed off has taken some of the tension out of it. I mean, the Chinese have, had lost one of the countries which stood against them, so they've managed to sort of put themselves in a much stronger position and made it, as Jack so rightly said, made it much harder for the U.S. to sort of build its case and make its case when one of its key allies that it was supposed to be defending has basically flip-flopped. There is always the potential for tension with the Vietnamese, but of course, they don't particularly want military conflict with China. They've experienced that plenty of times in the past, and they don't want to see it again. So, but of course, the Vietnamese will stand up for their rights. They have also a nationalist kind of constituency at home who are very worried about the South China Sea. So if they do give anything away, if the Communist Party of Vietnam backs down too far, they're going to have their own people to deal with. So it is a difficult situation, which is a tense situation, in a sense, with the Philippines kind of backing down, the Chinese have got a little bit of their own way, and it's kind of gone off the boil a little bit at the moment. It was very noticeable that Xi Jinping mentioned the island building in the South China Sea as an achievement of his first 5 years in office in that 3.5-hour speech at the Party Congress. So, he's no longer sort of hiding and trying to salami slice. He's very much saying, oh, we've staked our claim in the South China Sea. It's an indication, as we've been saying, of that assertive Chinese foreign policy. So the risks are definitely there in the longer term, both to trade, but also, as Jack alluded to, just this point about the U.S. Navy and military's freedom of movement in these waters. The U.S. military has seen these as international waters. The Chinese really don't like U.S. planes and naval vessels operating here. They believe those vessels are used to spy on China, and they would like to see the South China Sea as their waters, their backwaters, if you like, where the U.S. Navy can't operate with impunity. And that's fundamentally different from the U.S. vision of the Asia-Pacific region. So, you know, there is some longer term, I think, concerns about different visions of what the South China Sea should be, but it may be not erupting just yet.
Well, and I'm about a minute before our break here, Jacques. I'm just trying to imagine this president, or frankly any president, sitting down and trying to figure out how to negotiate this.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to see a lot of negotiations on this. One of the reasons that, as Simon says, the temperature has come down some of this is China, although there is the Xi Jinping remark in the 19th Party Congress, that's a big deal. In terms of behavior, they haven't pushed farther. They haven't implemented the arbitration decision, which has declared many of their claims and activities illegal. But what they have done is not continue building up. They've been putting more equipment and things, but they haven't done further land reclamation. They haven't really sharply elbowed the Philippines further out of the way. Duterte got some cooperation on that front. So that's taken it down some. But in the long run, this is a real battle over the rules of the road. In the very, very long run, if China becomes a naval power that projects force and wants to send its ships around the world, we may see a more U.S.-like view. But for now, they're still in the, we want to control what they call our near seas. And that's a sharp conflict with the U.S. And as the Philippines bails and as Vietnam, as Simon says, is reluctant to confront China, it's really becoming much more a U.S.-China bilateral issue.
That is Jacques Delisle, and he's a professor of law and political science at the University of Pennsylvania, also deputy director of the University Center for the Study of Contemporary China, and directs the Foreign Policy Research Institute's Asia program, obviously with us here in our Philadelphia studio. And joining us from Beijing, China, Simon Denyer, and he's the China bureau chief for the Washington Post. He previously served as bureau chief in India and as Reuters bureau chief in Washington, India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. Stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We're talking about President Trump's trip to Japan, to South Korea, China, Vietnam, and the Philippines, a 12-day visit to another part of the world, a long trip for this president and, frankly, for other presidents as well. Let me get Fran from Fort Washington, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Fran. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Sure. Thanks. Great show.
Thank
you. I was wondering if there is anyone along on this trip, since President Trump has kind of demonstrated, sort of an inability, or at least an inability to be rational about some things about this area. Is there anyone on this trip who has a deep knowledge of the area and all the ramifications?
Well, presidents generally travel with a pretty big entourage. Let me see if Simon Denyer can respond to that. Do you know Simon?
There are one or two people at a lower level who do have some knowledge. I haven't seen a detailed list of exactly who's going, but there are certainly people at a lower level who have some knowledge. The administration is having to learn fast about Asia, and to be honest, that happens in every administration. I mean, Obama, when he first came to Asia, didn't necessarily know an awful lot in 2009. His sort of pivot to Asia happened a little bit later. He sort of picked up, I think, on the need to have a strong Asia policy after going to the region. So, yeah, there aren't a lot of senior people who have a lot of Asia experience who can really help direct it. But I do think this is one would hope that this is a chance for people to hear directly from America's allies in the region, and this would be a chance for the administration to pick up the kind of knowledge that it needs.
Do you think that generally happens, Jacques, on trips like this?
Well, I think Simon says the first trip is often like that. Obama took a fair amount of criticism for his trip to Beijing in November 2009 for not really having his feet under him and seen as being a somewhat weak performance. And there was some, I think, muted glee in China about that. But they sort of misunderstood the law of equal and opposite reactions in politics. That I think creates an impetus for the president to be tougher. So I'm sure there's some thinking about that in Trump world about not wanting to make that mistake, but there may be other mistakes made. But there is a real problem that this is not a staffed-up administration. I mean, the number of positions that are vacant is truly jaw-dropping at this point.
Especially for this part of the world or just broadly speaking?
In general. So the person in who at the State Department in what would be the principal political post for Asia-Pacific, for East Asia-Pacific, is an acting, a career person. She's excellent, but Susan Thornton is just in an acting capacity. Tillerson doesn't have a very good rapport in the department, and there's no staff under him to speak of the political appointee type beyond a handful of positions. So that's a problem. And some of the people who would ordinarily be deeply involved in this do not seem to have been. So Mnuchin's part of this undertaking, the Secretary of Treasury, but he's got a little tax problem to deal with at home. Not his personal taxes, but as far as I know, but the tax bill. And so that's a distraction and absorbing it. McMaster, among national security advisors, has really not deeply engaged. Tillerson and Mattis have been much more engaged in the region, but we just don't have the kind of backup and the kind of depth of expertise because of the lack of political appointees, because many of the political appointees don't have the background that people often do, and because of this disconnect between the handful of very high-level political appointees and the career staff in what is pretty demoralized as the State Department right now.
But does that put the U.S. in a weaker position then, just the fact that we are understaffed as you describe it?
I think it makes it very hard to bargain effectively for getting much. I think the more likely effect is we're just not going to try to do as much. And I think that's why there's been this downplaying of the idea you're going to see much in the way of deliverables. And clearly there are some issues you can get some traction on if you place a high enough priority on them and focus what resources you have. That's why North Korea is so prominent. And I think there are some trade concessions that China is willing to give because some of them serve their interests as well, and some of them are relatively costless, or at least not big costs in terms of sacrificing their interests. But the really tough stuff, I don't think you're going to make the progress, and I think they would be wise to avoid trying to do it, because if you don't know fully what you're doing, the odds of getting a bad deal are higher.
So, I mean, let me ask you, the first stop on the president's tour is in Japan. We haven't really spent much time talking about Japan. The president did meet with the Prime Minister Abe, I believe, also at Mar-a-Lago. What should the expectations be about this trip? I think they're going to do some golf, and they'll obviously have some meetings as well. But what are the expectations?
Yeah. I mean, actually, the President Trump and Prime Minister Abe have a good relationship. I mean, Abe was I think, the first person to be at Mar-a-Lago, certainly before the Chinese. They enjoy a round of golf together. Abe's given Trump some golf clubs, too. So, you know, Abe is somebody who enjoys a good relationship. He will want to keep the discussion away from difficult issues like trade between the U.S. and Japan. But he likes the Japanese. You know, I was speaking to the Japanese recently, that they like the fact that Trump is getting tougher in terms of sanctions on North Korea. You know, they very much, I mean, obviously one would like, they would like them to be even tougher. I think the U.S. would like the sanctions to be even tougher. But they do see some meeting of the minds there in terms of being tougher on the North Koreans. So on the whole, I think that's one of the healthier, better relationships that exist, given that there are caveats everywhere about Trump's unpredictability and not having a particularly coherent line from the U.S. administration, to put it mildly, with lots of different people saying lots of different things. But you know, that's probably the one of the easier parts of the trip to get off to. When we get to South Korea, there are those issues, you know, with the position towards North Korea and certain concerns. So that's a little bit of a trickier one to negotiate.
Let me put TPP on the table. This, of course, was something that President Obama negotiated. President Trump has withdrawn the U.S. from the TPP. What are the implications for that, Jacques?
Well, I think this is widely and rightly regarded as the biggest unforced error in Asia policy. And the Trans-Pacific Partnership was this massive 12-country deal. It would take the next big step forward in deepening economic integration, not just lowering trade barriers, but dealing with a whole host of issues investment, trade, environment, labor, big package. And it is important for a couple of reasons. It was the economic leg of the security pivot to Asia under Obama. And if you're dealing with that region, if you're not paying attention to economics, you're really shooting yourself in the foot. Yes, there are huge security concerns. We've been talking about them, but economics, particularly economic integration, is the name of the game. Two big pieces of the TPP were getting Japan in, because Japan, obviously a huge economy, but one that is relatively closed. Pretty open world now, but Japan's relatively closed. And the other was Vietnam, which was going to be pulled up into the club. And so that plus, of course, bringing the U.S. political and security allies into this economic web was important for that reason. It was also important as a counterbalance to China. So this was partly to make these countries more economically integrated with the United States, to balance this tractor beam-like pull of the Chinese economy. China is now the number one trading partner for everybody in the region.
And China was never part of TPP.
Right. Now, part of the politics of TPP is, as it became harder and harder to sell in the United States, I mean, the expectation was once Obama received from Congress what's called fast-track authority to negotiate the TPP so the Congress would vote up or down. Usually when Congress does that, they will then approve the pact. Politics changed a bit, and the TPP was in trouble even under Obama. Secretary of State Clinton, when she was running as presidential candidate, also dissed TPP. But I think the expectation was she probably would have found a way to patch it. Trump withdrew it. And now we've got a situation where Obama in part pitched TPP near the end as a contest between the U.S. and China over who would write the rules of trade for the 21st century. That was probably unwise internationally, even if it was wise domestically. But it has a grain of truth. And now with the TPP gone, or with the U.S. out of the TPP more accurately, China's rival arrangement, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, the RCEP, is the only game in town. China's pushing it hard, and it has given Xi Jinping this immense propaganda opportunity to say China is now the proponent, the leading force for economic liberalization. Now, if the TPP were still in play, the U.S. could push back against that and say, the RCEP isn't that liberal, and you're not that great at this. But as it is, we've left the field. China seized it. And there's a lot of doubt about the credibility of U.S. commitments to multilateral efforts, especially under Trump.
Simon, you want to weigh in on that, and then we'll get some more callers in.
No, I mean, Jack's absolutely right. One American diplomat said to me before the end of the Trump era, you know, if we don't get TPP through, our China policy under Obama's in tatters. This was such an important part of the U.S. strategy towards Asia. There's a military and security side of it, but there had to be an economic engagement side to the U.S. strategy in Asia. And by walking away from the TPP, they've really blown away that leg of the entire Asia strategy, and there is nothing to replace it. America first and bilateral trade deals is not an appealing replacement vision for the Asia partners, and they don't want to see America simply as a military power. China is projecting itself as an economic power, as an investor, as a source of loans, as a source of infrastructure. So what's the U.S. alternative economic vision for Asia? And that's not clear. And blowing, sort of turning one's back on TPP has really blown a hole in that argument. The Japanese, I mean, that is a problem in the Japanese relationship, because Prime Minister Abe really wanted TPP. The Vietnamese really wanted TPP, and reformers within Vietnam had stake some claim on stake some political capital on joining TPP, and they were left holding the baby, as it were. They were left without a leg to stand on when the U.S. withdrew. So it's been a massive damaging. It's had a massively damaging impact on U.S. leadership in Asia-Pacific region.
Simon, just a quick follow-up, and then we'll get some callers in. Do these countries, and we've been talking largely about Japan and South Korea, Vietnam and the Philippines, do they see the U.S. then as a check on China?
Yeah, I mean, no one wants to see the U.S. and China coming to blows. No one wants to see the two powers, if you like, coming into a military confrontation, but they don't want to see China unbalanced, unrivaled, being able to call all the shots. So they do very much want the United States to be there, keeping the peace, as it has done, you know, for a long time in this region. So it's an important role for the U.S. to play. The problem is China is there. China is always going to be in Asia, and it plays on this. You know, it says we're the power that you're going to have to always deal with. The U.S. well, you don't know. One election comes, and then they change their policy. They're not consistent. And so that lack of consistency is something the Chinese will play on, and that lack of consistency has been really, really marked now because, you know, there was a US-Asia policy, and that was very sort of swiftly thrown into the trash can because it was an Obama policy, and everything under, you know, everything that Obama did had to be disposed of.
Let me see what Rick from Hocus in Delaware has to say. Rick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty, and two very esteemed guests you have today.
Thank you.
I've been following North Korea for a long time, and I saw that possibly two of their tunnels, their deep tunnels that they've done underground explosions, collapsed, and they lost a lot of technical people. And safety is one of their issues. And I wondered how your two guests feel about that and if they're aware that the tunnels collapsed and that they had a great loss of life. And
well,
I'll take my
All right,
yeah.
Rick. I'm looking at you, Jacques, and you're shaking your head saying,
I don't know about don't know. This particular tunnel incident, but obviously labor conditions not great in North Korea. We've also heard that they've been rattling the mountains with their nuclear tests. And I think it's a sign of just a country that's got severe economic and human rights type problems.
That's Simon, probably the best we can do for you, Rick. Let me read a tweet from Royce. He said, could the guest comment on the Russia obsession in the United States when China is clearly our greatest competitor? Can you take that, Jacques? Just quickly, because I do want to talk about the East Asia summit that's now on the itinerary.
Well, I mean, one doesn't want to downplay the Russia issue. And all of us East Asianists, of course, always want East Asia to take priority because we think it is important. And I think in the long run, it is the most important region with which we deal. But the relationship with China, which is probably the most fraught relationship as well as the most important one we have in Asia now, it's of a different quality than the relationship with Russia. The Russia one is clearly overwhelmingly adversarial at this point, even before it was a question of interfering in the domestic politics of another country. Yeah, but the China one, China does a little bit of that too, and there are issues of espionage and commercial espionage and things like that. But the relationship is much more complex and much less heavily negative, and we have absolutely no indication that China is doing things like the Russian hacks. They are much more traditional concerns in some cases about the relative gains from economic integration, the rivalry of a couple of different political systems, adverse security interests in the region. That's pretty much it. That's standard stuff.
Simon, the fact that Trump has changed his mind, I guess, and will be attending the East Asia summit, is that significant?
Well, I mean, obviously, it didn't send a very good signal to be skipping it, so that is reassuring. And, you know, one would hope that there are enough solid people in the, you know, within, despite what Jack said, and it's, you know, very right about the lack of staffing, but there are still some people around who understand these things in State Department, and I'm sure, you know, their voices were probably heard. So, you know, that's an encouraging thing, and maybe that's one of those instances where, you know, the administration can see it's making a mistake and quickly corrects course.
Final thoughts from you, Jack, in 20 seconds or less?
Sure. I think the East Asia Summit decision to attend is a good thing. American presidents have done it for some time now. The U.S. first got engaged about 6-7 years ago on that. And it follows on APEC. So the big meeting is in Da Nang in Vietnam is the APEC meeting of the 21 regional economies, the entire East Asia coastal belt plus parts of the western part of South America as well as the U.S. That's a big deal meeting. That's what's driving it. That's where they put on the funny clothing. But it's important to be at those presences, at those kinds of meetings.
Well, Jacques DeLille, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Simon Denyer, thank you for staying up so late and joining us on Radio Times as well.
It was a pleasure.
A pleasure
good
for us.
Here.
Yeah, nice to have you with us. Really appreciate it. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. You can also sign up for our newsletter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you for joining us.